Education Committee for Friday, May 6th is called to order. This morning, it's been a long day already. This afternoon, we will begin with a public hearing on House Bill 2339, and we'll get yours, Donna. Yeah. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2339. Mr. Keller, would you please give us an overview?
Yes, ma'am. House Bill 2339, the last time we heard this was on March 18th. It is the Cyber Awareness Bill. It has a Dash 4 amendment, and Representative Crummell is here to discuss his amendments.
Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26, which is Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. And I have before you, based on some information that came out about this bill, you will remember that there was some concern about it, but I think that we have addressed those concerns. And one of the things, I think that a couple of weeks ago you actually had to bring this bill back before the committee because of a fiscal that had been listed for this bill after it was passed out of your committee the first time. So this is the Cyber Awareness, Responsibility, and Ethics Bill, and before you, you have the Dash 4 amendments. And what we have done to avoid the fiscal and also to lower the workload and caseload on the Department of Education is that we have taken it away from them. And what we would do, so on the Dash 4 amendments, you will see that in Section 1, it says that the City of Hillsborough may establish this pilot program, and that they can run it, and then if they can also go out and using the weight and the sort of the power, I guess, whatever power we might have as a state to go and get grants for this type of a program, we are authorizing the City of Hillsborough to do that, and then other school districts may go ahead and apply for grant funding through the City of Hillsborough, and that way they wouldn't have to go out and chase these things down because the city is already doing that and doing it for the program that they have that they are wanting to expand in their area. You also have before you, I think, a letter that was sent to us by George Houston, who is the founder of CARE, of the CARE program, and is also he also works for the City of Hillsborough. He's a retired FBI agent and works for the City of Hillsborough Police Department and has a lot to do with this. And basically what they're saying is the way that we are reconfiguring the bill with the Dash 4 amendments, they are fine with, and that they are excited to help us out with. So what I would request from the committee, if you so see fit, would be to adopt Dash 4 amendments into House Bill 2339, and then once again move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And I don't think that there should be any kind of a fiscal impact on the state whatsoever with this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Representative Crummell?
I can't believe it had a physical.
Anyone
else?
Okay. Representative Crummell, our discussion, and I'm sorry for the back and forth here, but the file is noted for a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, so we have to somehow get that rescinded. So we can deal with the Dash 4 amendments today.
Madam Chair, if I might suggest would be to, if it would be the wishes of the committee, would be to have your motion, when you, in moving the bill, would be to have your motion reflect a rescinding of the, now I have not talked to the Speaker's office, and if you'd like, I can run up there and talk to the Speaker's office if you'd like to either recess or just don't go into work session yet, and then I we'd be glad to come back and let you know what the Speaker's office says about the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. But where there is no, if LFO or the Department of Education can come back with a fiscal on this one, it's going to be beyond me.
Well, it seems common sense to me. However, since it is bound to the file, I'm not sure. Do I have the latitude to just remove it? I don't think I do without a letter.
I think Madam Chair, if I might, what I've been instructed before myself is that if we're going to do it, then just send a letter to the Speaker's office as to why we removed the rescinded the subsequent referral. But if you'd like me to go up and check with them first, and just don't go into work because you're in public hearing now.
Right.
Just don't go into work session yet. Let me run upstairs and check with the Speaker's office, make sure that there's not an issue with it, and then I'd be glad to come back down and advise staff. And then if you at that point want to open a work session, that would be fine.
Okay, we might proceed down that trail. In the meantime, however, or prior to that, we have a question from Representative
Just
March.
A little one, and maybe it'll address certainly. Part of the potential cost here is I don't see anything in current law that would prohibit the city of Hillsborough or the city or the school district to do this now. So it doesn't impose necessarily any additional burden on, because they could, in essence, they could do it and other school districts could do it now without this legislation. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Representative March, that is correct. They actually could. But what this does do is that by giving it the authorization in statute, what we are doing is putting the weight of the state behind the city, so that when they are going out for grants and that sort of thing, they are basically acting on our behalf in that respect for these types of grants, and it's limited to these types of grants dealing with cyber awareness and responsibility and ethics.
Thank you.
Certainly.
Okay. Can we close the public hearing and reopen a public hearing or work session on that? So, Representative Crummell, if you wouldn't mind getting that accomplished and report back forthwith.
I will be back in just a few minutes. Thank you.
In due course. Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2339 temporarily. We will open a. We'll go to Representative Nelson and then Representative Greenleaf's bills, respectively. So we'll go to House Bill 2435. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2435. Mr. Keller.
House Bill 2435 creates a task force to research and report findings regarding the benefits and viability of Head Start program in Oregon. Declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you. Well, it looks like we have the good representative from McMinnville, and Michael, is it Eichmann?
It is, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Representative.
Thank you. Chair Flores and committee members, thank you for this opportunity to appear before you in support of House Bill 2435. I'm Representative Donna Nelson from District 24 in beautiful Willamette Valley. At a time when this legislature, along with the governor, is dealing with the need for additional prison space, we have an opportunity to eliminate much of the need in the future. We can focus now on a form of crime prevention that has been proven substantially successful over the past many years. That comes in the form of a fully funded Head Start program for all children in Oregon. And I'll take a moment to say that of all the things President Lyndon Johnson did, this is the one I'm most proud of, and coming from the same state of Texas, and that he was responsible for signing this bill when it came up 40 years ago.
It is 40 years this year.
40 years old. So I think it's the best thing that he did while in office. If we will bond together in common purpose as legislators, we will end the discrimination that prevails in educating our most needy disadvantaged children. No longer will we line up 10 little children like 10 little Indians and select 4, 5, or 6 of them to get a head start in education and in life, and let the others who remain in that line suffer from the lack of early knowledge, social skills, and healthy well-being. In my first term, I asked Governor Kitzhaber to fully support Head Start. And I think it was in this very room, and I said, you know, I'd like to go get 10 little Hispanic children all dressed up for Mass on Sunday, because they're always the cutest kids with all their frills and look so spick and span. And I said, and then, Governor, I'd like you to tell 5, come on, we'll give you a head start. Well, at that time, it was 4 out of 10. You 4 get a head start, and the other 6... we'll see in the Oregon Youth Authority in 10 years. For the first 4, we're going to pay $6,000 a year and give you a head start. For the other 6, we're going to spend $100,000 a year at the Oregon Youth Authority. Now, that sounds awful, but let me tell you, this is exactly what our previous sheriff in Yamhill County told me. He said, Donna, I can go to the first grade and pick out which children I will be seeing 10 years from now, almost the same scenario. Those children who do get that head start are almost 90% less likely to end up at that Oregon Youth Authority if we give them a head start for $6,000 a year. In vast research I conducted during my recent elementary teacher education at Western Oregon University, I found volumes of facts and figures and substantiated research that tell us Head Start is the most successful program we have ever launched to meet a special need in education in the United States. For that reason, I cannot comprehend why we do not do what we know will succeed. What will prevent school dropouts? What will prevent crime? And what will elevate a child's opportunity for a wholesome and successful life, as well as change the direction to a positive for an entire family's future? Not having the support of the governor or our legislature, the next best step we can take is to establish a Head Start task force whose mission will be to substantiate what has been accomplished with our partially funded Head Start program over the years, with the hope that the resulting research and report to the legislature will be sufficient to gain full funding in the next biennium. Unfortunately, that's going to cost us 3 years. 3 years in the lives of these little children. They'll already be in that first grade being identified by that sheriff. Unfortunately, those who didn't get a head start. While we lose 3 more years in which we could actually be changing lives of our children for the better, this research will simply prove what we already know. Head Start is a winner. It is a win-win formula, benefiting our children, families, elementary through collegiate education, the business world, society, and our state and our nation, and yes, even our taxpayers. The return on the investment is measurable and most likely one of the highest to be gained. In coordination with our Department of Education and Oregon Head Start, I am proposing an amendment to this bill that will work to the advantage of all. You should have that amendment that was provided by Dale Ford. I ask that you approve the -1 amendment along with House Bill 2435 today. I also hope that all of you will sign on this bill to give our children the head start that is as important today as anything we could do for the enhancement of the lives of our smallest and neediest citizens. And I thank you for this time. I also gave to you, there's so much research, just some facts, and I'm sure Michael Eichmann will, you know, be happy to give you any further information. He's done a fabulous job for us, and we're so proud of the leadership. But just some facts here, but I just urge you to, you know, get on your computer and see what you find out from the mass of research. And it's a program that we already know is successful. It's not something brand new that we have to try out and say, well, we're going to, you know, this will be a prototype for a year or two. This one's proven. And why don't we do it? It would be far better to fund these children in Head Start than it would be to add another, you know, X number million dollars to an education plan that's going to then take these children in a first grade setting, or hopefully maybe even a kindergarten setting, and start with them possibly too late in their lives to save them. So I'll take any questions, or you might want to hear Michael first.
Thank you, Representative. We will hear from Mr. Eichmann, and then we'll do questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Representative Flores and committee members. I'm here today as a representative of the Oregon Head Start Association. I'm also the executive director of a Head Start program, and happens to be in Donna's district in Yamhill County. And as Donna mentioned, we've had a program there about 20 years, but this is the 40th year anniversary of Head Start programs nationally.
I will insert here, just for the record, if you could give us your name.
Yes, Michael Eichmann, and my apologies. I guess one of the things I'd like to say, as a local Head Start director, we, at the moment, I have more than 100 children on a waiting list for Head Start in our county, and we're serving just about 212 children in the course of the year. But I have another 70 kids that applied for Head Start this last year who wouldn't have qualified under Head Start's income guidelines. They're actually the lowest of any income threshold for poverty programs of any sort. We would use 100% of the poverty guideline. But if you were looking at energy assistance programs or food stamps or WIC, a number of those programs have a little bit higher income threshold, and 70 more families applied for Head Start whose children would have qualified, and they do qualify for some of those programs. So we have a huge number of people that are waiting and would like to get into Head Start. And it is, we know that even because the waiting list is so long, during the year, fewer people sign up because they know they feel sort of fatal that they wouldn't get in. They just know that it's not a waste. You know, it's a waste of their time to get on the list, or they believe that, so they don't sign up. But we have elementary school principals calling me, trying to find out how do they get applications, how do they get us into their program so that they can get more of the children in their particular area. They're sort of competing sometimes to see about getting children that would be low-income children in their districts into the program, because they realize that those kids come much better prepared for elementary school. And I do know that the cost that Donna mentioned about the remediation, there's some significant numbers out there. It depends upon who you look at, and Donna's done some research, but the Economic Policy Institute has recently come up with a very good analysis of early childhood quality, early childhood programs, and you know, you can get estimates between $7 and $18 or $19 of saying that a return on the investment, the public investment in these programs. I think if we were to do some better analysis here, we might be able to market what the Oregon effect is, and I believe that's what Representative Nelson's efforts are, is to gather some information that's very specific to our state and specific to the program that we're offering here, and providing that for legislators. So with that, I'll close, and thank you for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Are there questions for either of our panelists? Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson, I actually think that the research you've already done and volumes of research out there substantiates the value of Head Start. It's a good program, and I'm wondering if maybe we need more legislators on here so we have more people that are committed to coming back and pushing for adequate funding for Head Start. I think that seems to be the missing piece here. I mean, I know you've changed some of the mix there, but I'd like to see more support for Head Start, and I don't know if going out and rereading the same reports would help that. So that's just a comment. And one other comment, our local Citizens Crime Commission really focused on juvenile crime for years, and they kept saying, okay, toughen the sentences, toughen the, you know, make more beds. And then they came back and said, you know, we've looked at it again. It's really early childhood. And that's where it is. So I think you're on the right idea. I think we need to somehow get better buy-in from the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you. And if I could good Chair Flores say, I wish, you know, it seems like every year we do this. I wish we had the family sitting here again today. I mean, if we had the time, but being the 6th of May, I knew we couldn't allow for it. But I could get the tapes from the previous two terms. And you see these families come in here and talk about how they were nobody going nowhere very quickly and negatively. And they'll tell you how it changed their life. I mean, we have one where the mother, I mean, this whole family had not one chance on earth to, I mean, come out of this mess that they were in, you wouldn't believe. And now she's going to school to be a lawyer. He's got his college education. Children that were identified as having all sorts of diseases and, you know, ADD, whatever, and all of that was phony baloney. I wish you could see this family. You know, wish you could see the flowers in their garden, because their whole life is so vital and beautiful. And what is so wonderful about this program is the parents have to participate. I mean, I have never seen anything like it. Talk about volunteers in school programs. We never had it in the PTA, I mean, or PTC, any of those parent-teacher organizations. But you have it here. And they stay a part of this these children's lives, I mean, forever, because this is their family. You know, I was reminded the other day we had another bill in the House, and I thought, my gosh, here we are wanting parents to be involved in their kids' lives, you know, want them to come to school, you know, want them to participate. This is one where they do it because it is required. I mean, it's good for the all of school, I think, all grades, that we make that a requirement. But it changes the lives of the entire family, and also their economic condition. I mean, I just love for you to see these tapes. It's just unbelievable. It's like Youth Challenge over at Bend, you know, where every kid should go that doesn't want to go to high school anymore. All of a sudden, they've got a program with discipline over there with the guard. It's incredible. And you see these kids, 99% finish school that were dropouts 2 years before. It's just incredible. So that's what we see here. We have proof. And I just think, I don't know any other way to get us, like Representative Marsh said, to get us closer to the heart of the governor who's going to finally sign this bill. And I hope whoever's coming in next time loves, you know, this program like we do, and studies it and knows the success. I don't know any other way, unless y'all tell me, how we can get it moved, unless we say, wait, here's the facts. I mean, this is the success. This is your return on your investment. You know, this is our cost. We can also do what has been done so well. Continue to seek contributions from our communities. We're on the checkoff list on your income tax. I hope y'all give us some of your refund from all that money you make. Here. Well, I'm talking about the administrator, not the legislators. But but anyway, I just don't know any other way to get us moving, you know, forward on making this program possible for all children, so we don't have to make that selection. You know, that worst, to me, it's the worst form of discrimination in the state. We choose 5 of you 10 little children for Head Start.
Representative Dolan?
Yes, this question is for you, Michael. The program is 40 years old, and we started in Oregon 30 years ago?
No, actually, there was programs that started back then. The program in Yamhill County didn't get started. It was one of the latter programs to begin, and our program started just about 20 years ago.
Where I want to go with that is when the program first started, did we serve a fraction of the identified also at that time?
We did. We've always served it. And it's a growing fraction of the number of children. It's sort of stagnated here lately, but we have always served a fraction.
So we could identify those that were eligible for Head Start 30 years ago and go see where they are now and get a very accurate picture of what the advantage of Head Start is, or at least an indication of that. For that reason, could that be done? Is that a conceivable study that we could do?
I believe so. I think it would take some data and some tracking that isn't currently being done, but it is a possibility. And I think that would be one of the things this committee would look into, is what are some of the methodology. I know the National Head Start Association, there are people there who are researchers and people involved in that realm of work who would be more than willing to set in and actually excited about the possibility of being invited.
And we could target Oregon.
We could.
If I might, Madam Chair. Then I want to talk about adequate funding and the budget. We have an opportunity to fund Head Start this year at a higher level. Are we going frontwards or backwards with our funding right now in Head Start?
Chair Flores and Representative DeLume. Dallum.
There was a wink-wink.
Representative Dallum, we're going backwards. I just want to remind everybody that when we got set in this last segment, there's too much to go through the different periods of Head Start that we've had in the state. But this last one, we were supposed to have 100% funding of all of our kids by 2004. That's how far behind we are.
And what do we
100%. We're not even 50% this year.
We're at 47%, I believe, this year. What will we be next year if we were to take the governor's budget?
And use it all for Head Start?
No.
I believe the governor has a
That's
budget.
That's why you're a politician, Representative Nelson. I get it.
She's leveraging dollars every moment.
But I think where we're going is we're continuing the backward slide on the percentage of funding. And I think I can look down the table, and I know that my colleague, Representative Roblin, and I both commented on the that you can identify Head Start students.
Absolutely.
When you start school. So I not only support your notion of a study, I support your notion of more funding. I'd like to do the study now. I'd like to do more funding, as much funding as we can right now, so that we can do all the things you talked about. And without being maudlin, as an educator, I can tell you, if we could squeeze one more kid in, it is that valuable. Thank you very much.
And I just might mention very quickly, sorry, Michael, Chair Flores and members of the committee, there are all sorts of financing opportunities. We just need to get Sundar Lim, let him loose on this, and he'd, you know, find us money in Korea for this. You know, I mean, he'd find a market that would fund it. But there are many things that can be done, many types of sponsorships, scholarships, you know, that we could set up in some type of fund, much like the student assistance program for universities. Let's just remember, if we start it lower, I mean, we maximize it. You know, that money, I'm for the kids, and I was a college teacher as well, and a secondary teacher. So, I mean, I'm not saying take it away from them, but we can get a huge return on like amount of money, you know, 15 years earlier. I mean, and it'd benefit everybody. But I want to thank the churches who have taken on responsibilities. We have one in our county in Newburgh that has taken on an incredible job. Well, if you won't give us any money, we'll sponsor this program. They're getting a new building.
We are Joyful Servant Lutheran Church.
Yes.
For 20 years we've been there.
So I want to compliment these groups.
Churches
are doing that. And we're getting a new one in Sheridan, a new facility. So these kids, you know, are seeing school when they really, their brain at that age of their lives is 10 times larger, has 10 times more capacity than it'll ever have past the age of 7. Boy, what we could do. So I would appreciate your vote.
I guess I'd like to close by saying I really think what Donna has said, and in truth, Head Start is more than just a child development program. It's a human development program. And she mentioned the fact of we work with everybody in the family, and truly the adults are some of the people who gain the most. And that relationship that happens for young people who haven't had good guidance or for whatever reasons haven't understood how to interface with that education program, by training them early how to deal with the teacher and how to be involved and engaged in their children's lives, it really does make a difference. And I think those benefits spill over. And for those of you, I mean, I see a number of heads nodding, you know that this is true, and I think it really is beyond just child development. So thank you for your time, and we really appreciate it.
Can I just say one last thing? I promise.
Oh,
this is it.
Famous laugh.
It's so important. The chalkboard project that is not completed yet, but to date, you know, we have to remember what their top three, you know, answers have been in what do we want out of education. You know, the first one is reading, writing, and arithmetic. So that's the basics. So let's start them when they have the greatest capacity, plus languages, a language capacity. Anyway, so reading, writing, arithmetic. The second is make the schools comfortable for parents. You know, the parents have this fear of going into schools. And this is number two. Nothing I'm saying. That's what parents are saying across the entire state. No better time to start them than, you know, when they're 3 years old, which is great. And it's wonderful. And third is eliminate the unfunded mandates on schools. So if we would do that, that 8 to 10% that the schools have a burden on, because we've, you know, said do all these things, you know, do these SIMs and CAMs. If we would knock off those unfunded mandates, that's 8 to 10%. Well, out of this $5 billion budget, that's $500 million. That would more than fund what's needed for the schools, the K through 12, plus Head Start. So just telling you, there are ways to do this. Thank you so much. I hope you'll vote for the Dash One in this bill. Be grateful.
Representative Nelson, you have seen a lot of heads nodding up here. I, too, have been visiting. I have visited the Head Starts, and I have talked with the parents, and I have talked with the instructors. I have talked, and I've watched the children, and that's the one that just absolutely...
So excited about everything.
It is a success story that needs to be broadened and enhanced. Our predicament here today, and we do have one more who would like to testify, and that's Tricia Smith, but is that we did not schedule for a work session. So, and I need your Dash One amendments to be in legislative through Legislative Council. So I assure you, we will get those Dash One amendments. If you'll present them, bring them back, we'll get them back, and we will have a work session on this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pretty bad when two people with back surgery. One at it, one needs it.
Tricia Smith. Thank you, Representative Nelson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association, and we proudly represent employees in several Head Start agencies in Oregon. I am here to offer our qualified support for this bill. We appreciate very much Representative Nelson's passion for Head Start. We share it. We understand, as she does, that Head Start may be one of the most cost-effective programs that we've ever developed in terms of the benefit to our entire society. We are continually dismayed that the legislature does not fully fund Head Start. We also suggest that, as Representative Nelson did, that you have a statute requiring you to fund Head Start at 100% level by 2004. The statute still exists on the books. We just pretend it doesn't. It exists there because the legislature at the time knew how important Head Start was, but like this legislature, perhaps just doesn't have the dough. We hope that through this bill, we can raise the awareness in the legislature, which is, we believe, the place it needs to be raised. As to the benefit of Head Start, we are a little concerned, though, about spending money on a task force to prove to legislators what they already should know. And I don't know what the fiscal is on this bill, but the House budget, as it came out this week, still does not restore the funding that the governor's budget cut to Head Start, not fully. It restores part of it, but not all of it. We would suggest that there's lots of information out there, and we'd be happy to provide it to help disseminate it among legislators, and perhaps the thing to do is to fund Head Start rather than fund a task force to tell you that you should fund Head Start. And so if you would help us get that message to the budget committees and help us fund Head Start, because Head Start, unlike K-12, where you can cut program, in Head Start you can only cut students. You can't cut program. So if you cut money from Head Start, you are reducing the number of students that may be served. And so that makes it an even more important issue, we believe, in terms of funding. So with that, I will leave you to your work, and thank you very much for considering this very important issue. And as I said, we appreciate Representative Nelson keeping it in front of you.
Thank you, Ms. Any questions? Thank you very much. We'll
vote.
I just wanted to make...
Oh, I apologize.
Certainly.
Actually, if it's okay. No, it's not a question necessarily. But I really like this bill, and I wish that that it can go forward. And I just wanted to also bring to the attention something that I mentioned to Representative Nelson early in the session, which we haven't talked about in a long time, but there's a Senate bill, 240, on the other side that I think would dovetail real nicely with this. And it would create a crime and delinquency policy institute. And if you could get those two things together, because I do think the Head Start is such a great crime reduction program, I think you should have a better chance of passing through both chambers.
Thank you very much. And okay. Representative Lynn.
Yes. And are we on our own public hearing now at this time?
We're in public hearing, just about to move beyond that.
Okay. And then as I see, agree with this bill, there's no that the money involved in it. No pay for the legislators, no pay for the volunteers working with it. Does it have any referrals to the budget committee for this month?
Representative Lim, it does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
To Ways and Means.
Because interim committees or task force require administrative support. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2339. We will, Representative Greenlick, with your indulgence, we'll just use a very short space of time to wrap up the business on the previous bill that we had looked at, and that was House Bill 2339, I think.
I think you closed the hearing on this one.
I just closed the hearing on House Bill 2435. And we will move into a work session on House Bill 2339.
Madam Chair, I move the -4 amendment to House Bill 2339.
Representative Dahlem has moved the -4 amendments to House Bill 2439. Is there discussion?
I don't know if I have the -4 amendments.
They would have been with the material that was with you today. Behind the staff major summary, attached to the staff major summary. We'll get there.
All right. Did maybe Jim, if you just explain that, or is that?
I'm sorry, you were not here, and I will do a quick overview on what the -4s do.
What it's going to do is going to allow the city of Hillsborough to actually administer this program rather than the Department of Education. Okay. That takes the fiscal away.
And it removed then the subsequent referral.
Okay. Great.
Okay. Representative Dahlem has moved the -4 amendments to House Bill 2339. We've moved beyond discussion. Is there any objection? So moved.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2339 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and the referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Dahlem has moved House Bill 2339 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and the referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Discussion. Okay. Those of the opinion that House Bill 2339 should be reported to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and the referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. The motion having received the required majority is declared. We will close the work session on. And Representative Crummell will carry that bill. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2339. Thank you very much. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 2560. Mr. Keller.
Yes, ma'am. House Bill 2560. You need to grab the right one. You should have a -4 amendment, I believe.
Dash three.
You can help with a -4.
-3. And Representative Greenleck is here to describe the amendment.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mitch Greenleck, representative of House District 33. I'm happy to be here today to ask you to adopt the dash freeze, and I would hope you'll move into work session and move the bill out of this committee. The dash threes do two things, plus associated technical matters that go with those two things. It, one, changes the effective date of the bill from July 1st, 2006 to July 1st, 2007. I heard the testimony here and agree that 2006 was too short a time to make the bill effective. That moves us at the breakneck speed of moving towards an integrated comprehensive research university in the metropolitan area by 2017. The pace is accelerating, exhilarating to be moving that fast towards what's required for the metropolitan university, but that is what this does. And the bill does a second thing. It puts in, as you'll see on the dash threes, line 9 through 18, a statement on funding of Portland State University. When the Oregon State University moved to its public corporation status, apparently there was misunderstanding about what was intended on the part of the legislature in terms of funding. I was an administrative official of OHSU at that time, and my understanding of the funding arrangement was that the university would not ask for an increase in funding for three biennium, which the university did not do. I understand since then, speaking to some of my colleagues in this building, that the understanding was that the university would get funding for three biennium and then not get any funding after that. Since that opinion is opinion held by one of the co-chairs of Ways and Means, it has some significance. I understand that we cannot, in the 73rd session of this assembly, bind future legislators, bind future assemblies, but I did want to put this into the statute to make clear the understanding that I have as the proposer of it, and that's that the Portland State component of the university, of the Portland State University, which will remain an independent university for several years, and its successors will be funded as a part and in the same manner as other institutions that are currently in the Oregon University system, and that's the the function of Section 20B of the amendments. I'm here to ask any questions, answer any questions that you might have, although let me make one more comment. There's been a fair misunderstanding of what it means to be a public corporation. We continue to hear about my effort to privatize Portland State University. I spent a fair amount of time with the legislative council to help me understand what it means to be a public corporation, and let me just put on the record my understanding of that. A public corporation is what it says. It is a public corporation. It's not a private corporation. And it is the difference between the public corporation as currently operated at OHSU and the rest of OUS is that the public corporation is specifically under the conditions of the statutes that it is made a part of the condition. So if you go back and read OHSU's original public corporation bill, and I think we've done the same thing in this bill, which was copied after it, it puts the new university status under public corporations in an explicit set of statutes of the state. That's why it's so long. It is a public corporation for almost all the things that any other branch of the executive of our government is. It is a part of the executive branch of the government, and a public corporation, and to see how that specifically applies, you just need to look through the statute and see look through the bill and see what statutes are included in that bill. So this is in no way a privatization attempt. It keeps both universities and ultimately the combined university under the direction of a board appointed by the governor and serving at the pleasure of the governor, and it is under the obligation of all of the statutes as a public corporation that are listed in the bill itself, which is the reason the bill is so long, because it specifies those statutes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have not heard that there is a rescinding of the subsequent referral to the House Budget Committee or Ways and Means. And if that's the case, I'll ask you today to move this on to Ways and Means. If there has been a rescinding that I haven't heard about, I did not think there was.
I haven't seen the banner come in. So
what I hope you do today is to move this on to the due pass recommendation to the House Committee on the Budget.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Green, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand that section that you were just talking about, that talks about it getting its regular funding. As 2017, when it becomes this new university, it'll probably have a new name. It won't be OHSU. It won't be Portland State. Does that continue, or does at that point when they become free of any expectation from the college, just like the old people thought the other one?
Well, it is currently the Portland Metropolitan University's board that will be managed that. But it is, the intent is that the successor organizations, as long as it's a public corporation, will be funded in the same manner. The truth of the matter, I believe that by 2017, the OUS will be a very different body. This whole thing will change over time between now and 2017. And each new legislative session will have its own shot at how and what to fund. But this is to make explicit what at least I intended by the continuing support. And I think we can worry about it again. You and I can re-meet here in 2017 and re-discuss it.
Follow up.
My concern is if it were to truly happen, then other than the campuses that are separated by a few blocks, there should be an intertwining of all these programs. And so it would be difficult to identify one from the other, would be my hope. And therefore, the funding mechanism might become more difficult to identify which is which.
There are two components at the Oregon University System. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, in the room. There are two components at the university system OUS serves now, and one is the management and sort of general policy component, and the other is the education component. I firmly believe that management component of OUS, as it works through its future plans, at least in terms of the larger university of the state, will disappear anyhow. And I believe we will be forming public corporations for one or more of the universities. My hope for that, if I were the king and had my magic wand, is that we would find a way to not only maintain but to strengthen the component for educational coordination. And for example, now you have Provost Halleck in the room, who continues, even with the public corporation, to serve on the education coordinating body of OUS to make sure OHSU is a part of the education coordinating. I would see that sort of thing coming about, but there's a long road between now and 2017, and if there's anything we can predict, it's that the higher ed system that the higher ed system in 2017 will look very different than now. If there's one thing I think we need to affirm, it's that the state of Oregon needs to continue to fund the education mission of its universities, of its public universities. We've done a terrible job of that. I hope there's nothing in this bill, should it pass in this session or the next session or by initiative in between, there isn't anything that will slow down the funding, the currently terrible funding of higher ed in this state. I don't believe this state can survive the economic development crisis we have if we don't begin to invest more in higher ed. You remember my testimony on this bill. My testimony on this bill is to enhance economic development by producing the kind of university engine in the metropolitan area that I believe is needed for economic development. But as David Sorensen pointed out when suggesting my bill should name this Pretend State University instead of a Portland State University, because we only pretend to support that, I just want to make sure I'm not doing anything in here that in any way whittles away our commitment to funding higher ed, particularly the education mission of higher ed.
Representative Dolan.
Yes, Representative Green. In establishing the Portland Metropolitan University Board of Directors, I see no one else signed up to testify. Does that mean that the litany of people that came into the room when you first visited us have all had a chance to participate and have decided that if we go to 2017, all parties can live with this?
Did you want me to close
all parties are
now?
Firmly in support of this bill now. No, I'm just kidding. The parties who testified against it in the past continue to think it's a wacky Mitch Green-like idea and do not support it. I have, however, met since then and have worked very closely with a whole group of people around the state, including both OHSU and PSU, were kind enough to get together their leadership to give me a chance to explain what I was doing to their leadership. I met with students now in both universities. I met just this week with the Business Advisory Board of Portland State University School of Business. I am continuing to meet with other business and citizens group, but I don't think you need to ask them to testify. The testimony that they delivered to you in the past is still in force.
Thank you. One follow-up. Curious more than anything, did you catch every freshman legislator as you caught me and explain to them the virtue of this move?
It has been my objective to personally lobby every single member, the other 59 members of the House. I'm almost there. When I finish that, if we move this out of the House, I'll be personally lobbying. But you're right, I caught you before you were sworn in. Because I knew you were going to be a leader in the education field and would see the obviousness of this.
See how good these people are?
I was a no, but not now.
No, what I think Representative Greenlick really did was capture those visionaries within this body to sign on with him. He will check the names on the sponsor list. Representative Mark.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Greenlick, I think you've actually made the case for the argument that we have discussed, and that is, I mean, actually we discussed even how do you fund higher education, particularly in the Portland metropolitan area, but you actually brought out how do we really structure higher education in Oregon entirely. And I, you know, if this bill was saying, let's go look at that issue, and how do we fund higher education adequately, and what is the correct structure that we do to, you know, for each of these universities, and particularly the major ones, I'd be there for you. And I want to put on record today, I appreciate the dash threes. I think they're moving the right direction, in that there's a little more time. But I don't think this is the right bill at the right time. I have a unique position on the Ways and Means Education Subcommittee. And in looking at the funding for OHSU, the funding for higher ed, I don't think this is going to get us any traction in terms of helping students and helping people get into the system. And so I'm withdrawing my sponsorship for this piece of legislation. I'm sure the chair is happy about that now that I've left the other luminaries here. How do we go about funding higher education?
Representative Marsh, let me say this. If you had the bill that was going to pass this legislature that stabilized and increased funding for higher education in the state, and this would come after that in line, I'd be there with my arms around you supporting that bill, because I think I think that is the number one problem. I frankly can't see how to get there from here, and I don't think this does anything to stop that from happening. In fact, I think if it does anything, it furthers the probability that we can have this kind of a discussion. As you remember in the last session, I proposed an interim report, an interim committee to do exactly that before this committee. Universities were not crazy about that idea, but I thought the time was right for that. Now I think that just turns into a roadblock to moving where we need to go. And while I believe we need to have a parallel effort to deal with higher ed, and even a parallel effort to deal with the structure of higher ed in the state, a plan for the higher ed, which I think incidentally the OUS board is in the midst of working on, I believe this is a logical and inevitable first step to move in this direction. So I would not support one more tedious interim commission that nobody does anything with. I think we do this or we don't do this. If we don't do this, I'll be back with another way, and perhaps helping you create a private way to look at this in the interim so that we could come up with an answer on the funding higher ed. But if we wait to create a way to fund higher ed in the way you and I both believe higher ed needs to be funded, in order to make this kind of innovation, in order to make this move towards what there are many people around know needs to be the formation of a viable, comprehensive, national stature research organization in a research university in the metropolitan area, we're going to be waiting around 10 years more before we can do something 12 years off. I think it's time to move.
Thank you.
For the question.
And I'm sorry to have lost you as a sponsor. I admire that. Perhaps we can discuss it again in the Subcommittee of Ways and Means.
There you go. Thank you.
Further questions? Did you have a question?
No.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Representative Greenough.
Thank you all very much for your patience.
And seeing no one else signed up to testify, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2560. We will open a work session on House Bill 2560.
Madam Chair, I move the -3 amendment to House Bill 2560.
Representative Dahlem has moved the -3 amendments to House Bill 2560. Is there discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Lynn.
So this is the bill that the preconditioning merging two universities by when? 2017. So still 12 years away.
Yes, sir.
Okay. You know, I was not supportive of the bill in the beginning. Somehow during the process, I'm convinced I like to be a shark. So maybe this might be a good thing in the future. But one reservation I have is that it is the legislature, because we are forcing this university to merge together instead of that the universities themselves coming out. But as I understand it, two universities are against of this merging at this time. So we are forcing them to do that. That's one of the concerns I have.
To the table.
Yes, to the table.
Thank you for your comments. Further? The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Representative Berman?
Aye.
Representative Sheila?
Aye.
Vice Chair Dahlem?
Aye.
Vice Chair March?
These are on the amendments?
Yes.
Aye.
The amendments, -3 amendments are adopted. I guess I gave an extra gavel in there, didn't I? So we'll do that.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2560 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Dahlem has moved House Bill 2560 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended, and the bill will be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? I see a couple of hands. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do thank the good representative for bringing this forward. That a lot of people that I respect think that this is bound to happen sooner or later, and we might as well get the ball rolling now. I'm more than happy, as a courtesy to the Chair and Representative Greenlee, to send this down to Ways and Means, preferably with a neutral recommendation, but I think I could vote for the with the due pass recommendation. But I would like to reserve the right that if it does come to the floor, I may end up voting no on the floor, just because I'm still not there yet that taking this out of OUS is the best way to go.
Thank you, Representative Shields, and that is the purpose of a courtesy vote, to reserve your right to vote no on the floor. So thank you very much for that. Representative Roebling.
I was going to say ditto.
Back at you. Okay.
Okay, I was sending for Ways and Means, but budget committee, since we don't have Ways and Means at this.
I think there's a process in place, and unless there's a glitch in the process, which there is from time to time, they'll work it out.
All right.
Okay. Okay. Those of the opinion, House Bill 2560 should be reported to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation, and the bill referred to the Committee to Ways and Means by prior reference will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 No.
Aye. Having received the required majority, the bill is adopted or declared passed. We will close the work session on House Bill 2560. And we will move to a public hearing on House Bill 3075. We will stand at ease until the room clears. Thank you.
Oh, yes.
We have Dash 1 amendments, and we have Randy Harnish from ODE who worked on the amendments that could walk us through them.
Mr. Harnish.
The Dash 1, Randy Harnish with the Department of Education. The Dash 1 amendments were devised by a work group, including myself, representatives from the Department of Human Services, DHS, and the Juvenile Rights Project. There was some language that was overlapping between another bill, House Bill 3168, that dealing with the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, and the deletion of sections 3 and 4 from the original bill are in reference to cleaning up that overlap. The other changes were regarding a kind of a compromise on the records request and sending timeline, and we came up with a 5-day on request and 5-day to send. And then there was some language that was developed by the Department of Human Services in the new Section 4 on the Dash 1 amendments that would require the Department of Human Services to report back to the legislature on the cost of implementing and complying with this law if it is passed. And that basically is Dash 1 amendments.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Harnish? Thank you very much. Janet Ahrens, please. At all.
Thank you.
Chair Flores and committee members, thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you a little bit about the impact of House Bill 3075. I am the Executive Director of the Oregon Alliance for Child Advocacy. My name is Janet Ahrens. We are a statewide nonprofit association of 33 different children's service providers throughout the state of Oregon. We are opposing this bill. In addition to the many kinds of programs, services that we provide, we also, about 10% of the total foster care that's delivered in this state is done so by private providers, and we represent a significant portion of that. We're very concerned that this bill is trying to fix a symptom instead of a system, and that it's doing this at the expense of foster parents. I have two individuals here with me today, the Edalls, and they'd like to make a few comments to you about the impact that this bill would have on foster parents. Meg Everly, with the Director of Family Foster Care Network, and Tegan Schlatter with the foster care case manager with Albertina Curran. So they'd like to make a few comments.
Thank you. For the record, if you'll identify yourself.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Meg Everly, and I'm Director of the Foster Family Care Network. We are a coalition between Albertina Kerr Centers, Boys and Girls Aid Society, and Morrison Child and Family Services. And we serve about 90 foster families, and these are hard-to-place children. Really, I want to talk to you a little more about how it will affect foster families. And every day we face the stark reality that there really are more foster children in the state than there are foster homes. And while we really see the intent of this legislation is commendable, we think the reality of how to be implemented could tend to diminish the amount of foster homes. Mandating the transport of children to schools far from their foster homes is not the solution. Oregon needs to address the core problem, finding and supporting more foster homes actually in the neighborhoods, getting more money for recruitment for those foster homes. Finding foster parents in Oregon today is a challenge, and I worked for the last, a year ago, I worked for about a year recruiting foster parents, and it's very difficult, and these are very special people. You hear the negative things in the news, but foster parents are very wonderful people who have to spend a lot of time with their kids, and often it's 24/7 where they have to have the kids in sight and sound, and it requires a lot of challenges. At the Foster Family Care Network, the location, what I would find, when you're trying to recruit a foster parent, the location of where the child would go to school was a key consideration because it would be very difficult to spend a lot of time transporting children. So when we would recruit foster parents, they would be very interested in where the school might be. Foster parents want to care for children who go to school near their home. And if they're required to add hours of driving daily onto their work schedule, because the reality is today that there are most foster parents work full-time. We have one program that actually needs a stay-at-home mother and a full-time or stay-at-home father. And one person who works, and we really have a hard time finding that kind of rare commodity anymore. They would be required to add hours of driving daily onto their work schedules, and they would often decline to do foster care. And this would be especially hard in the Portland metropolitan area, where if you live in Hillsboro and you had to drive to North Portland or Northeast Portland, it would require a great deal of your time. For example, today, actually, Morris and Albertina Kerr currently have foster homes in Northeast Portland, which are caring for children from Beaverton to Hillsboro. And this would be very difficult. It might even be impossible. We had one foster parent who was going to come and testify with us today, and she had a crisis with her child. And she really actually has a child in Hillsboro and lives in North Portland, said it probably would be really difficult for her to do this. In fact, a few years ago, she quit her job because the child was so far away school from her workplace, and she was called several times a week, which often happens, and it made it too difficult. So she quit her job to do foster care. Dealing with the logistics of busing or transporting children this far would make the placements extremely difficult. In addition, the parents often have to make numerous trips to schools for meetings, and the bottom line is that the legislation will result in fewer homes to serve an increasing pool of children. Also, for private providers, we serve a minority, of course, of foster children in the state, but we can provide close supervision and support because we have actually more available staff and fewer clients. So this legislation provides no funding to reimburse the homes of private providers. And this will make it even more difficult to recruit and retrain quality homes for the children we serve. We could be asking foster parents to spend hours transporting children and incurring added expenses in these times of high gasoline prices. In some cases, it might mean we'd lose existing homes. We wholeheartedly concur that keeping foster children in the neighborhood schools, when possible, should be a key consideration in placing foster children. It's always our first choice when possible. But this must be determined in the best interest of the child, and school placement needs to be addressed on a case-by-case basis. And this legislation basically does not address the fundamental problem of supporting the foster care system. Instead, it will create new stresses in an overloaded system. So I'm going to turn over to Tegan, who can give you some kind of real-life examples as a case manager of how this might impact.
Excuse me, I usually wait till the panel is completely testified, but Representative March has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to clarify, we're not requiring the foster parents to provide the transportation in this bill. If you look on the first page, on lines 26 and 27, it says the public or private agency that has placed the child shall be responsible for providing the child with transportation to and from school when the need for transportation is due to the placement of public or private agency. So I think somebody who analyzed this for you missed that part of the legislation.
How would that be done?
Madam Chair, Representative Mark, that is, in all practical intents and purposes, the delivery of the transportation would be provided by the foster parent. The responsibility would lie with the agency, the placement agency, but what would happen is that they would simply delegate that to the foster parent. There's no mechanism for DHS to provide a series of buses to drive around the state and physically deliver the children to schools if it was requested that they remain in their original placement school, or their original school prior to placement. So and what I believe you have heard in an earlier hearing from the Department of Human Services is that they do anticipate a potential fiscal on this because of reimbursement costs to foster parents. We know the same is true in with our members who are private providers of foster care, that the agency itself, in other words Albertina Kerr, would not be driving around picking up and delivering students to school. It would be the foster parent that would have the responsibility. That's the direct point of impact.
However, I just want to add one thing. In a case recently with Morrison Center, they mentioned to me that they did have to draw a child was needed to go to a school far away. It would take over an hour, and the school district would not bus a child over an hour. So what they did was use staff time to drive this child, which in turn takes staff time and resources away from treating the children on site.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam.
Surely.
Thank you, committee members. My name is Tegan Schlatter. I'm a foster care case manager at Albertina Kerr. This is a good idea. However, we do definitely try to place children wherever we can as close to their current resource as possible. We work with very hard to place children, with children who have very diverse and specialized and complex needs. And this definitely would be a hardship on our agency if we had to figure out how to do this resource and on our foster parents. We have kids all over the metropolitan and extended area in Portland. And right now I have a caseload of 10. If it was mandated those children had to stay in their home school district, it seems to me that 5 of those 10 children would not have been able to be placed with our agency, which leaves DHS, who often is referring the kids they refer to us, to multiple resources, leaving them with nowhere to go with these children. Just to add, in addition to the foster parent burden, it would be that the burden on their work schedule. Our foster parents are required to work to have another income other than simply their foster care income. So they have to get to work but then get the kids to school. That would be a problem. Also, foster parents with multiple children would take them a long period of time to get all of those children to school. And if that were the case, some of those children would have to miss some of their school day so that other children wouldn't be left unsupervised at schools or four schools open and close and after they close. And just to express how big this is, for example, we have a family in Forest Grove who has a child who would need to go to school in Beaverton, a family in North Portland whose child would need to go to school in Tigard. So to have some way to make that happen organizationally is a pretty big monetary and staffing problem. In addition, I'm going to just thought,
oh, the train jumps.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it.
My fault. I got stretch off.
That would be my main concern. In addition, if we were going to go say we had the funding and that wouldn't be a problem and send children in taxis, we have a safety issue placing children with transportation that's untrained. People are untrained because of the severe needs and the severe developmental delays, but then oppositional, aggressive, violent behaviors. And untrained taxis, we have a group of taxi providers in Portland who all have criminal background checks, but we've still had issues with boundary issues with them, nothing significant, but taxi drivers giving children things and things that are a safety concern for us. That's all. Thank you.
Madam Chair, you and the committee members should have also received an email in the last day or two from another foster recruiter, and her name is Rhonda Womack. Her points were very much in line with the issues that you've just heard here, that as a foster parent recruiter, that they see this is a significant barrier to recruiting and retaining foster parents. And she, one of the points that she makes is that stability is so critical for these children that when they have to leave a foster home because a foster parent can no longer make the accommodation to transport them, that just continues to increase the instability that they have to monitor. And just another comment about the schools. Foster parents routinely deliver children to schools if it's within, you know, a 10-minute or so drive, and because they recognize how important that stability is. However, there you need to recognize when we start moving children further out from their foster home, they're not just delivering them to and from school. They're going to the parent-teacher conferences. They're picking up the children when they're sick. If the children are engaged in sports or other extracurricular activities, it requires providing transportation for all of those educational elements as well. We're not only concerned about what's happening, the impact on foster parents and the foster care system, but we're especially concerned that this is really a state public policy issue. This is not a transportation problem. Transporting children who have been moved multiple times in foster care, who are now looking at possible placement in another school, this has to do with how we deliver our foster care services in Oregon. This bill tries to patch the symptom of seeing kids moved around too many times. Real solutions would include recruiting and retaining more foster parents so that we've got a bigger pool of foster parents available in more neighborhoods, reducing the number of foster care placements for a child, doing a better job of matching children with foster homes, and frankly providing prevention and intervention services on the front end that will keep families together so that we're not putting them in foster care. So we think that this bill does not provide those solutions, and we're hoping that you'll consider our comments. We don't want to make a state problem a problem for foster parents.
Thank you, Representative March.
Yeah, I think that's what we're trying to do here, is get some stability in these kids' lives. I mean, if you look at what we're saying is, shall be considered a resident for school purposes. You're trying to make sure that they can continue to attend the school first. So we're looking at the child first, mm-hmm. instead of looking at the foster parent first.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes school is the only stability in that child's life, especially if they're getting bounced from foster parent to foster parent to foster parent. I mean, it might be that the school provides that stability. So what I'd love to see happen is your folks get together with this bill was requested by the Juvenile Rights Project folks, mm-hmm. and see if you can reach some sort of language that would work for both sides. Because, I mean, we're trying to put the child's interests first. Mm-hmm. You're talking about the interests of the foster parents. I want to see the child's interests here first. And I know that's when you say foster parents, that you really mean you're trying to stabilize the child. But let's think child first Foster parent second.
Chair Flores and Representative March, very well said, and thank you for making that point. I think it's an important one. That is, however, what we are driving at. That children are placed placed in more than one school.
We're trying to provide the transportation for it too.
Well, are attending more than one school because of a multiple foster placements, not because. So we've got it's a front end system issue. What we're looking at with this bill is a back end system fix, trying to deal with the symptoms. The reason that we have this kind of instability and the reason that we want to try and keep kids in the school where they currently are whenever it's appropriate is because they've already been moved too many times. And there are other mechanisms that we can use, other strategies that we can use to successfully, when we have to take kids out of their home, successfully place them in foster care and give them the kind of continuity that they really need. We're all in agreement. Again, you make a very good point. We're all in agreement that we need to look at the best interest of the child. But busing them or having foster parents drive them to school is a symptom rather than the...
Right, and I see that as the afterthought in this bill. You're seeing it as the focus. The focus is first finding the placement with a foster family in that district. That's where I see the focus of the bill as, and providing the transportation if you can't. And that, so I think if you relook at it, get together and work, maybe you can develop some language that would work for this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And thank you, Chair. I'm sorry, and Representative March. We work closely on a number of issues with the Juvenile Rights Project and on foster care advocacy work, and we're well aware of their intention with this bill. What they're really In our conversations with them, they've made very clear that their intention here is to help put pressure on the state of Oregon to generate more foster care capacity, so that they'll have those choices available to them in neighborhoods where the kids or families currently exist. So this is a strategy for a point of pressure in order to help us do the kinds of bigger system changes that we need to do, and which you pointed out we need to address.
Thank you.
Representative
Dahl. I'd go to the caseworker if you had to choose, and I don't want to put you in a bad position, but you have to choose between a stable home and a stable school when you're placing a child. Which would you pick?
I would pick the stable home.
Thank you.
I
think you are then looking after the child, aren't you?
Yeah, I can give you an example if you like.
Yeah.
We have one child who, is that all right? We have one child who has been very hard to place, has a history of oppositional violent behaviors, has mental health issues, has been in and out of residential treatment placements as well. We have finally placed him with a foster care provider, and it's working spectacularly. We didn't expect it to be so successful. He's really bonded with his foster father. He is successful in school. He is mainstreaming from his contained classroom successfully, very anxiously, but successfully. And I doubt we would have been able to do that if we had to say the foster parent, we got to figure out how to get him to another school. Plus, the foster parent also does intervention at school. If there's a problem with his child at school, he goes to the school.
So my point is,
we're farther away.
That as a caseworker, you always look after the best interest of the child first.
Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Shields and Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to get an understanding of the extent of the problem. So in some of the more, I guess, conduct disordered kids, behavior disordered kids, or whoever the ones that you're having difficulty with, how many times in a year are they moving?
Do either of you have them?
You know, I guess I would say... on average, three or four times.
Three or four times.
Until they find a home that can stick with them, really. Really, it's the issue of foster parents having enough training and enough support that they feel that they can deal with a child who's yelling and screaming at them and having tantrums and being fairly violent without and get through that period to getting the child to a more stable place. And until we find that, it's three on average, maybe.
Follow up?
Follow up.
So do you think there might be any reason to believe that stability in the school might actually improve their performance and their willingness to stick with the same foster family?
Yes. We have a child right now who's in Cortland Public, and we worked actually with Juvenile Rights Project, did a lot, really good advocacy, and he had to change placements but stayed in the same school, and I think that's been really successful. But it's within Cortland Public, so they're providing transportation, which has really been helpful. And he's not that far. The foster parents aren't that far, which is nice also.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I read it, and maybe you're reading it better than I do, my feeling is that this law does is it says that the school district has to accept this child. You know, just because they've moved, and the other school district has to let the other school district accept it. It's not that you have to put them at that school. There are times when it may not be the most appropriate, and even if it is appropriate, but there are concerns at times when you place a foster child in this neighboring school, and it's maybe even easy to transport. Well, the neighboring school says, no, that's our child now. We want the school district money for that child. And you're saying, no, it would be easier if he stayed in the same school. And this bill gives you the right to say he can stay in the school he came from, or he could go to the school he's residing in. I mean, because it didn't change that in the law. So it gives you some options that you might not have had before.
Chair Flores and Representative Roblin, as I understand the bill, this is a decision that's made by a juvenile court. So if they determine that it's in the best interest of the child that they continue in the school that they're in prior to the district they would be moving to in their foster care placement, then they would need to be transported to the school district where they had been attending previously, regardless of what district it was in. Is that addressing your understanding?
Follow up on that one.
Follow up.
This line 24 may continue to attend the same school child attended prior to placement through the highest grade level. The previous one in line 22 shall be considered a resident of school purposes to the school district. So that means that they are a resident, so they can continue to get school support. But I can't read where, and in the first line it says, notwithstanding this other section, the juvenile court determines that it is in the child's best interest to continue to attend the school that child may attend prior to the placement of the school. That doesn't say it shall. It just says that it is making a determination that it can't, in my opinion. So I don't see this saying you have to put it in that school.
It's up to the judge.
I am interpreting it, I think, very much as you are, Representative Roblin.
And we are in agreement.
Testified to.
So you don't have to stay there.
And that's my understanding.
Okay.
Representative Flynn.
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair. And that the House bill is 3075 is like a good bill, but as I see it, the transportation is the key issue here. Even though we are acting on the best interest of the children, we are requiring the placing agency should be responsible for the transportation. If they don't, it goes to the foster parents. And nowadays, the high cost of gas and plus others and time and the distance, this is going to be a problem as far as I can see. So with these bills in it, I don't think I can support this bill.
Thank you, Representative Lim. Please just, I'm wanting to kind of clarify my understanding as well of your testimony, your collective testimony, that potentially conveying the cost of the transportation by the agency and or private placement, which would eventually filter to the, and the responsibility for that would filter to the foster parent on some reimbursement level, but that potentially has the impact of reducing, by virtue of perhaps willingness to become foster parents, their foster parent pool. Do I understand that correctly?
Chair Flores, you do. That is precisely our point. That the gas isn't inexpensive anymore. But that these children, you cannot just, the children that we deal with in the in our systems cannot just be put on a bus or a bus pass purchased for them. The larger cost is the loss of potential foster parents and the amount of time and stress on the foster parent to be able to be available to transport the child, but they're leaving other children at home unsupervised. They can't leave children on a schoolhouse doorstep because they've got to get to work, and there are employment flexibility issues, transportation issues the individual foster parent may have as well.
Thank you very much. That does at least confirm my understanding, and I guess a follow-up to Representative Lim's comments that concerns me how we're serving the best interest of the child if we're diminishing the pool of opportunities of foster parenting. But we do have others to testify, so
yes,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Baker and Kevin George, please.
Chair Flores and committee members, I'm Brian Baker. I'm a staff attorney and senior education attorney with the Juvenile Rights Project, and was here on April 4th and have come back to answer any questions about the Dash 1 amendments. I'd also like to comment, in the interim between the 4th and today, we have worked very carefully and with all of our community partners and have had an ongoing dialogue with Ms. Ahrens and the Alliance. And regrettably, we weren't able to come up with amended language that could satisfy their concerns. I do, however, disagree disagree with the concerns that they've raised, and I'll clarify that. We've thought long and hard in drafting this language about the potential impacts on placement, on foster parents. I was struck by what Representative Greenlick said, if he were king and had a wand, my four-year-old daughter would say, if you were the Parkley princess with a wand, if I had a wand, we would repair and make changes to all of the systemic issues that impact our foster care system. Unfortunately, we have not been able to do that. We continue to work. I anticipate I'll spend my entire career as an attorney working on these issues. This bill, House Bill 3075, addresses a specific issue of great import. As we testified earlier, we have incredible mobility of our students. Each school, each time a child moves schools, there's academic loss, particularly to reading and math. There is loss of friends, of connections to teachers, of connections to programs. The main issue that I took away from the testimony the committee has just heard is the concern about transportation, about distance, about special needs children. As was testified, the private programs serve approximately 10% of the children in foster care, so a fairly small percentage. Those are very high needs children, and the way that we drafted 3075 was, initially, the presumption continues, as it does in current statute under ORS 339133, that the child is resident in the school district where he or she is placed. That continues, that will continue with 3075 as it has always been. So a child placed in a private caring agency in a particular foster home, at the get-go, you are looking at your local school. You are looking at your school close to that home. That continues to be the case. What we created in 3075 was a possible, for lack of a better word, a possible escape hatch, an opportunity for all of the parties, parties of the children's program, the attorney, the court-appointed special advocate, the caseworker, the case manager, for everyone to come together and say, in this particular case, should we consider, should we go to the juvenile court judge and look at the child's best interest at having him or her remain at the prior school? As I testified early on April 4th, there are particular times where a child is really connected to a program, and particularly a child with disabilities. It may be a structured behavioral classroom, maybe a teacher, an administrator. There's a connection there and a willingness to continue that child. Those are instances where we would go back to the court and say, can we make this happen? Can we look at keeping this child at that prior school? We were very careful in writing 3075 to not to leave it very open at how the court would look at that best interest determination, to be able to consider all of the concerns that were just raised. What is the distance? Who is going to provide the transportation? What is the cost? What is the amount of time? What is the impact on the agency, on the agency's ability to maintain those foster parents? In talking to Ms. Renz, we had proposed adding some language to put put in a continuum of different types of transportation. That wasn't satisfactory, but just to clarify some of the options that might be out there, it could be anything from a public bus pass, it could be a transportation service, car and van service, a cab, it could be a volunteer, it could be someone from the PTA, again, working with that small group. It could potentially be the school district steps forward and says, we think it's in this child's best interest to keep them here. We have a month left of school. Why would we change this child's placement for 30 days to a new school placement? We'll do it. We'll pay for that transportation. The point is, the bill does not preclude anyone from coming in to the court hearing to provide that very relevant and important information to the court to make that best interest determination. And I wholeheartedly agree. I do not disagree with the representations that more likely than not, given distance or time on a foster parent, that's going to be a situation where we would not continue that child in that school of origin. We're not going to transport from Hillsborough to Gresham. Logistically, you look at the time, the distance, the traffic, all of those things, it simply wouldn't work. Those are the types of facts that we would present to the judge. It's a difficult balancing. We feel, the Juvenile Rights Project feels, that we have very carefully crafted language that leaves the greatest flexibility for the court to hear from all constituents, to make very individualized case-by-case determinations. But at the bottom line, really begin to focus on this issue of mobility of children in foster care. I testify that very often, very commonly, my clients move 4 to 5 times during a school year. Data shows that there's an academic loss of 4 to 6 months with each one of those moves. It's incredibly paramount to work towards creating school stability. I equally, as a children's attorney, do not want to do anything that would in any way jeopardize our foster care recruitment. We talked about that at the last hearing, that we have worked very closely with the Department of Human Services to foster the programs of neighborhood foster care and maintaining children close to their homes and in their schools for that stability. We've worked very carefully to not have a fiscal on this bill, to try to project, you know, what numbers of children would actually be impacted. We suspect it is going to be a fairly small number, again, and that's based upon maintaining the current status quo as the statute does with residency where the child lands. But again, having that escape hatch and a few children, that the court will say, in this particular circumstance, we should move that child. Welcome any questions that came up with the testimony, please.
Representative Dolan.
In my experience, when we had a difficult student, we usually staff that, and we would have a whole host of agencies involved. And parents when possible, schools when possible. Has a school ever denied a stay put for a student when it was in the best interest of the student?
Chair Flores and Representative Dallin, it has happened. It does happen. We do endeavor to bring those teams together. As Ms. Schlattler had testified earlier, I had a particular case with her that fortunately was within the district boundaries, and we were able to keep that child within the same school. But it was also an opportunity where all of the parties came together, the foster parent, the school psychologist. We had a teacher from the former school, counselor, we had a counselor from the new school. We all worked very diligently to assess the appropriateness of having that child in the former school. He was wanted in that former school. In that particular case, it wasn't so much of an issue because we weren't crossing district lines, but just to throw in a hypothetical, had that been across district lines and the prior school, for whatever reason, did not want to take the child back, they would not have had to. We would not have had the opportunity to talk with the juvenile court judge to explore best interest, to air out all of those concerns. I think it's really, in some ways, the children that are served by the programs under the Alliance that have the highest needs, the highest mental health needs, the highest behavioral needs, who may be in some ways the least likely candidates to remain in the school of origin, partly because their behavioral levels are high. They burn out teachers, and so there isn't that necessarily that incentive to keep them if that's how the school team is feeling towards that child. However, the other side of that coin is that those kids, when they are successful in a particular program, all the more reason why we want to keep them there. They may not have that similar success in the next school.
Would this bill then make the school less than an equal player in the partnership? I'm concerned that the educational voice, I've not found them to be unreasonable, and I've not found them to not look for the best interest of the child. And if stay put is in the best interest, that's usually what the school will subscribe to. If move along is in the best interest, and there are considerations from the school. So I'm wondering if we're taking the voice away from the school when we tell them they must.
Well, we, Chair Flores and Representative Allen, we believe that we've kept the voice of the schools, of the districts in the process. Again, keeping a very open process for this best interest determination to absolutely include, and I had that in my prior written testimony, to absolutely include the school district in that discussion of should a child move, should a child stay in the prior school placement. They are an absolute essential partner and piece of that discussion, because part of that exploration in making that best interest determination is to say, what were the benefits, what is working particularly well at this prior school? Was it that structured classroom? Was it that teacher? Was it that administrator? What were the connections there? Why are we seeking to maintain that school of origin? We're providing a forum. I think my feeling is what happens right now is we have a process that can permit inter-district transfer. It's discretionary. There isn't necessarily a mechanism to gather the parties together, which this bill provides, to really have that full discussion. And I think what happens is in the movement of children, the crisis, and it's often in crisis, that piece gets lost. Everybody is focused on the immediate placement, accessing the program, the next program, the next foster home, and unfortunately, the school issues of school placement falls to the wayside and isn't necessarily revisited. That may be due to a failure of any one of us to raise it, to pursue it. But I would add that for particularly for children's attorneys, as the advocate for the child, our state, unfortunately, through the Public Defense Services Commission, does not at this point in time believe that the educational advocacy is necessarily part of the state-funded advocacy that we are assigned to do as children's attorneys. We do it. We do it on a daily basis as part of the Juvenile Rights Project, but that doesn't necessarily occur out there around the state with other children's attorneys.
Madam Chair, if we might, I would like to ask the caseworker if, when child placement is considered,
please. He paused mid to speak. So a waiter arrived.
All right, my name is Tegan Schlatter. Could you repeat the question?
Yes, when you're placing a child in these most difficult situations, do you consider family, school, best interest of the child, and talk to the school, talk to the family, talk to, are all of those players in the game brought into the process?
That would be the ideal. It depends on the circumstances. There are many times we have to place children immediately, and we don't have the time to bring in all those different players.
Do you have the authority to leave? I believe you have the authority to leave them in the school they're in if you want to. Can you do that?
Not across districts, necessarily. Then we have to register them in the foster parent's home district, and that district can say, oh, well, where the child is the best placement. We'll transport them. Or they can say, we'll serve the child. We have a child in Forest Grove who we'd like him to be in school in Beaverton. But Forest Grove said, oh, no, we can serve his IEP. He'll stay with us in our school district.
So you're moving children quickly because for their own protection, for their own, for the family, whatever the reason, and the school kind of catches up second?
Generally.
Thank you.
Unless we have a longer time to place.
Sure.
Gretchen Groblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess this is kind of a comment, not a follow-up, because you just kind of alluded to that when it's going across district lines. There are a number of districts that have inter-district agreements. However, I am finding in my business that when I was there, that those agreements are starting to exclude special needs children more and more because the district that they live in realizes that if they send them over here and that person ends up needing a full-time aid with them, they can bill back the other district. And so the other district is saying, I'm not going to release that child because there's a liability that I have exposed my district to, but this other district may seem that the best deal is to have this extra person and send me a bill for $35,000, which I have to pay, regardless of what it is. This bill would, in a sense, say, no, the legal district is the district from which they came. Therefore, they would get the school support, and they would not have any recourse to the back of the district that the foster parent is in, as I understand it. Would you agree with that? I mean, I think this, because it determines that that is their resident district, therefore, the district where the foster child would not have any say, nor would it have any liability.
Chair Flores and Representative Rowland, that's correct. By maintaining that residency, that prior district where the child attended received the funding, the state funding, the additional ADM for the special needs of that child, had developed that individual education plan, including the aid if that was part of it. And again, those are oftentimes for those higher needs children, those are the services that are in place that may be really working for that child, that as we go to the next school after placement, district will say, you know, our resources are such that we don't have those. We don't have those aids. Just this morning, Portland Public held a large meeting to talk about cuts that are facing that district and cuts to special ed and particularly to aids, for example. So that becomes part of that difficulty of trying to, again, create a good, supportive educational environment for that child in a new school, and then potentially having to do that second, third time during the school year. Some of the placements through Ms. Schlatter's, am I pronouncing
Schlatter.
It? Schlatter, I'm sorry. Through her program, are shorter term duration, 60, 90 days, and so we're under a very tight timeline again to look to the next placement and where the child is going to change potentially school placements again. So 3075 again is very focused on attempting to try to maintain that school stability across a school year for that matter. I know that Mr. George is going to testify about particularly about the language of adding a preference to look at placements close to the neighborhood school, again focused on stability. Juvenile Rights Project doesn't disagree with the need to absolutely attempt to try to place children first with relatives. We worded our bill not to put our near school preference at any higher level than the relative preference. We simply want another preference to be considered by the court, by the agency, when you're making that foster care placement. There will be times where that relative placement is a relative perhaps the child has no contact with or no relationship to, and perhaps in that situation you would look at an opportunity to keep the child closer to that home school and maintain that school stability. These are very, very individualized case-by-case types of decisions and should include, as I said, should include all of the community partners in ultimately making those determinations. And we feel that we've strived towards
made an effort
to Friday afternoon to have flexible language in this bill that will allow that. We added in the provision of a report back to the legislature because there are unknowns. There are unknowns of how many children are going to be affected, what are the impacts going to be, what are the logistical and transportation issues that may come up, will there be fiscal impacts, that we come back and write not just that report to include information from Department of Human Services, but also from the private child caring agencies for their impacts. Because, again, as I said, we absolutely do not want to impact foster recruiting, foster placements, but we want to begin to make a significant dent in this mobility issue and in the poor educational outcomes of our kids in foster care.
Let's hear from Mr. George.
Thank you, Chair Flores, members of the committee. My name is Kevin George. I work as the foster care program manager at the Department of Human Services. Part of the nuances of trying to always work very closely with your partners is sharing testimony ahead of time, so I will try to be brief as Mr. Baker identified several issues that we have at this point. We were here also a month ago and testified as a neutral position based on the fiscal impact and had worked with the Juvenile Rights Project on looking at the amended language to say, is there an ability for us to look and try to study this thoroughly over the next biennium to really come back then with a report to say, this is how much it really and truly is costing. We have come up with a lot of fiscals, and Chair Flores had asked the question last time, and I reported that we believe it would be somewhere between $200,000 and $700,000 per school year, and that was based merely on reimbursement rates to the foster parent. Again, it's very speculative and for lots of reasons, and part of it is that we actually do a lot of this already. And so there is some capacity within our system to pay for some of this, to actually provide some of this. And so it would be offset by some of the current things. The challenge of it is that as we talk about this is a very case-by-case specific situation, we make those decisions now. And we make them in concert with family meetings, with attorneys, with courts, with schools. And so by putting it into law that it requires that change, all of a sudden that kind of starts backing us into a corner that if we got a situation that is unique, we may get into a dilemma that's where our problem, quite honestly, is. The fact of the matter is that Brian Baker in Juvenile Rights Project, and speaks for the entire Juvenile Rights Project, and I speak for the entire Department of Human Services, we agree 99% on all the research about there around educational stability for kids, and that the foster kids have they have more things against them than going for them in many ways, and school is that stability issue. I think it's important for this committee to know that when we talk about stability problems, and the children that are with the private agencies are higher needs kids, and so those kids are having more challenges and more difficulties, but then across the board, all the kids in my system, our system, we have about 85% of those kids do not move more than once or twice a year. So that's really the number we're talking about. So the kids that really are moving a lot during the year are the kids that are really having significant problems for a lot of reasons. The piece about again, the case by case, where that comes into a problem is if the court is actually making that decision and it's not just back to that collective group again, making what's really the best decision for children. And so we would believe that there would be times where we may be in disagreement and can't solve that, and so we again go into a court hearing and having a judge make those orders at that point in time. I think the other piece about House Bill 3075 is that there are a number of issues, very small, minute issues in there that actually mean a lot to several people, and that's why I think you see a different group here today than you did a month ago, and if we have another hearing, we'll probably see a different group based on things where many things were pulled out that really affected the Department of Ed, but many of the things that still impact DHS specifically are there. And one of them that I want to really draw your attention to that we did not speak about last time, and Mr. Baker talked to it, is actually in Section 2, and my written testimony talks about that piece of it. We have 30% of our kids are with relatives. The department places a high value on children being with relatives whenever possible. So when a child comes into foster care, the first questions we ask, quite honestly, are not where their school is. It's where's grandma, where's auntie, where's uncle, who can take this child? And so by having a relative placement preference, somebody with a legal parent-child relationship and a school placement all in the same prioritization, we believe that it will impact our ability to continue to do relative care. We need to have that preference that sooner or later you keep adding things to a placement preference, It's no longer a preference if you got to look at all those things. So we believe the bill does address the need to have neighborhood-based placement further down in Section 2, but having it up there in the first stands, I think, is problematic. If we really honestly look at supporting relatives in foster care, there's another bill out that's running around the building here now about supporting relatives for adoption, and so it's that continuation of saying we as a state value relative placements continuously throughout, so we think that will be problematic. It is our intention to continue to work with the Juvenile Rights Project, continue to value relative placements. The fiscal impact is still a very unknown animal out there, and I think, quite honestly, if we really got into saying what is the sticking point, it is who's going to pay for that. I believe one question was, well, wouldn't the school district, if it was in the best interest of the child, just agree to pay for it for the next month? They absolutely do that now. If we have a bill that says they don't have to, that the Department of Human Services was, you bet there's going to be a conversation about who's going to pay for that. So that's where we're running into struggles. I know when I talked to foster parents about this last fall, again, literally this morning, I have a state foster parent advisory group that comes in and advises me on policy decision-making. I briefed them on a number of policy or a number of bills, and this is one of them. And the questions that came up from some of them, our friends over in Eastern Oregon, was, wait a minute here. You know, we have a long way to school. What does that mean to us in small rural areas as well as the urban areas around? If I do have to go across town, I may have two kids in care. I can't leave them at the doorstep of the school waiting for the school to open before I get to the next one. How am I going to do that? So it was those things that I think are all things you take into consideration when you make that plan. But again, it's the beauty of being able to make that plan as a collective team right now. When we start legislating some of that stuff, I think that's where we get into trouble and mandates that people can't honor. So that would be my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. George, Representative March?
Actually, it's related to Mr. George, but goes back to Mr. Baker, because Mr. George brought up on lines 16 through 18 on Section 2 on page 2, the added language, and placing that school or educational placement up in Section 1, it raises its importance to a very high degree. In other words, equal that of a relative. Would the Juvenile Rights Project feel that just leaving it down below under in C on lines 30 and 31 and taking it out of Section 2, paragraph 1 up there above, would do you think that would at least, it's raising that as an issue, an important issue for the court to consider, and yet not putting it the same weight as the relative? Is that a sort of an acceptable change from the Juvenile Rights Project?
Chair Flores, Representative March, I believe that would be fine. I think we have always represented to the agency we wanted to add in this preference into the consideration. I specifically don't believe that we've talked about moving it down. Looking at Mr. George, most of our conversations have you had some of that conversation? The difficulty I think is we want to somehow put forward that this piece, this particular piece of remaining in a neighborhood school, it's that issue of trying to create the continuum. What's most important? What's second most important? We feel like this provision has significant import of looking at maintaining neighborhood school. That was the thought of putting it up there. I drafted that initial language. I again did not want to put it above the relative. If we were to move it down, hopefully it wouldn't be lost in the mix. It's difficult. The wordsmithing is very difficult to try to. How do you unenumerated preferences, and how do you show that focus or that significance?
Thank you.
Representative Dolan.
This is the part of the meeting that educators, caseworkers, counselors all hate, because we have to trust one another. And if we move one criteria to the forefront, then we no longer have to fall back to the part of the meeting we hate. as I've sat in these meetings with the sheriff's office present, the school present, the caseworker present, and all of the players that are impacting what are usually very tragic cases, the factor of placement is just one of many. And to give it any more weight is to strip that team of their ability to address the needs of an individual. By and large, those teams catch a lot of static. They do the very best they can. And every time we tie their hands, we make them less successful than they might have been on the next case. So I, for one, can't support any factor that hasn't been reviewed by all the players at the table. I just can't do it.
Further questions? Mr. George, you indicated earlier that in response to a question I had in our prior session that you thought the cost of this would be about $200,000 plus per school year.
Madam Chair, yes, in the prior testimony, you had asked the question,
right.
What do you speculate?
Right.
And we had speculated $200,000 to $700,000
right.
per school year, and that was based on a number of assumptions.
Right.
And those assumptions were being provided to me directly from the Juvenile Rights Project that any child over the age of 12 in the Portland School District area would not be included in that financial piece. Any child, it would be unreasonable for a court to order a child to be transported more than 10 miles one way. So we excluded all that to say, okay, if that's all that's left, here's what it would could potentially cost. So whether it's unreasonable or not for a court to order a child to go 12 miles or 13 miles or 15 miles, that's up to that individual court. So those would be costs that would be not figured in that $200,000 to $700,000. It also is directly related to what the other folks spoke about in terms of who's going to do that. If the foster parent can do that, it's one thing to reimburse mileage. If they're unable to do that because they've got two or three children, and now we have to find a volunteer, a taxi service, some other van service, caseworker time, that's where costs start skyrocketing when we start looking at personnel.
Thank you. And Mr. Baker, in regard to your suggestion that you could use these alternative sources, i.e. public transportation with a bus pass and some others, and how do you suggest that that's in the best interest of the child if they are high needs and you're putting them in a public situation?
I think, Chair Flores, I think that what we've written into the bill is a individualized, as Representative Allam just raised. We absolutely need to maintain a process where the community partners, where the team does look at the individual needs of the child and considers the special needs, the disabilities, the behavioral needs of that child. And that process is what is envisioned in this bill. We would, as I said, maintain the current provision of residency where the child's placed. However, if we were able, through a dialogue, through a process of the community partners looking at that child's best interest, to address all of these myriad of factors, distance, special needs of the child, form of transportation, cost and payment of that transportation, those are all factors that would be considered by the court, by the parties, in presenting that information to the court to make that determination. And the court, hearing all of that information, very well might say, we can't do it here. We can't do it here. It's too far. It's too expensive. We don't have a safe form of transportation to do it. We're going to have to not try to maintain that prior placement. However, if we could go to the court as a group, exactly what Representative Down was saying, and say we have worked out those dynamics. We do have a safe form of transportation. We do have a way to pay for that. And as Mr. George had testified, already frequently that transportation sometimes is provided through reimbursement to foster parents, sometimes through a bus pass. And of course, if it's a bus pass, it's generally an older child who's capable of using that system safely without behavioral issues. But I've had clients also who have been transported and maintained in a school of origin through TriMet Lift Services, for example. Because of their disability, they qualify for those specialized services. We've had developmental disabilities sometimes provide a skills trainer to work on bus etiquette for being able to participate, ride on that lift to school. So there are ways to create that
safe transport. There will be children. There will be children with very high levels of special needs where we won't be able to maintain that school of origin because of these logistical issues, whether it's cost, distance, possible impact on foster parents. And again, I bet those are absolutely legitimate reasons to come forward to the court and say, I have four children in my home. I can't logistically get them to all of their different schools and get to my job and continue to do foster care. Very clearly, the court would say, I'm not going to impose that upon you. That dialogue is what's envisioned in House Bill 375.
One additional question, and not to be circular in the discussion here, but is not it one of the items of consideration when determining where a foster child would be placed by the actors that are involved here, that they could have that child be placed in an area with a foster family within the same school district, and that accommodation is now made. Is that not correct? Or that consideration is not made, is it?
That factor, that accommodation, is the ideal. I do not believe from my experience in working in the system that is what naturally results, and it's for a number of different reasons. It's everything that we testified to earlier, the lack of a number of foster placements within the neighborhoods where children are coming from when they enter the child welfare system, difficulties recruiting, difficulties supporting our foster parents. There are so many large systemic issues and difficulties with our child welfare system, and that really impact this issue. The bottom line is that despite the initiatives, despite the efforts to try to do that, to try to maintain in neighborhoods and maintain that school stability, we're not successful in doing that. And the data shows that the negative outcomes for children in foster care are significant in their academic loss, in the increasing behavioral difficulties they have, the school exclusion data, that results. It's to look at the costs or to try to project the costs, or simply to focus it on $200,000 or $700,000, also loses sight of what are the systemic costs post school failure, the penetration into the juvenile justice system, the cost of more restrictive placements for children if they are unsuccessful in family foster homes and have to move into residential treatment programs or into youth detention facilities and so forth.
I think you moved to the cost question. That wasn't the purpose of my question to you, so I appreciate that commentary.
Chair Flores,
yes.
If I may interrupt, I actually also like to answer that question because I have, as I testified earlier, Brian and I, or Mr. Baker and I, agree on 99% of the issues. I disagree on this one. We absolutely look at neighborhood placements for kids. When kids come into care, we look for grandmas, aunts, and uncles. We look for who else knows this child, and we have a significant number of our families who we specially certified for that child and that child only. We ask teachers. We ask schools. In the Portland area, certainly from the capacity issues right now, we are struggling in many of the urban areas because of the capacity not having foster families there. In the rural areas, I would beg to differ on that. We had a wonderful article in the paper here about 3 or 4 months ago down in Jackson County where we recruited into the school a teacher. She was so impacted by that, she recruited two other teachers to do the same thing, and they were keeping their homes open for those kids that come in from that elementary school. So that is a value that we have been taking into consideration for a number of years now. Continue to strive for that.
Further questions? Thank you, gentlemen. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3075. And seeing no further business to come before this committee, we will stand adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.